Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Boosters. An FDA advisory panel authorizes another shot for Johnson & Johnson vaccine recipients ages 18 and older. Then it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart analyze President Biden's efforts to alleviate supply chain issues and navigate Republican pushback to vaccine mandates. And filming a revolution. A musician's mission to bring archive footage of a 1969 concert series and its call for social justice to audiences today.
This is not just putting a concert together. This is correcting history.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. An FDA advisory panel has endorsed a booster dose for another COVID-19 vaccine. Today's action involved Johnson & Johnson's single-shot vaccine. The FDA advisor said the extra shot can be administered 2 months after the initial vaccination. We'll get details after the news summary. Attorneys for Nicholas Cruz say that he will plead guilty to murdering 17 people at a high school in Parkland, Florida in 2018. They announced it as Cruz appeared at a court hearing today. The defense said that he will also plead guilty to 17 counts of attempted murder at a hearing next week. A jury will decide later if Cruz gets the death penalty. In Afghanistan, at least 47 people were killed today and 70 wounded when suicide bombers attacked a Shiite mosque in the southern city of Kandahar. The carnage came during Friday prayers. Afterward, locals cleared away debris as witnesses described a coordinated strike.
After the attackers came, they fired on the guards and threw a hand grenade. One blew himself up in the corridor, and the other entered the mosque and detonated his explosives as worshippers were busy with prayers.
Tonight, the Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack. It has carried out several deadly bombings since the Taliban seized power in August. A long-serving Conservative Party lawmaker in Britain was stabbed to death today. It happened as Sir David Amos met with constituents in a town east of London. Investigators combed the area for evidence as people paid respects with flowers and notes. Police arrested a 25-year-old man. There was no word on a motive. Across Lebanon today, schools, banks, and government offices closed in mourning for seven people killed in gun battles. Shiite Muslim and Christian militias fought for hours in Beirut on Thursday. One woman told today of how her daughter-in-law died.
Sniper shots were coming from the buildings on the other side, and they shot her while she was still in the house. She's the mother of five children. She's young. My son's family is ruined. What should he do?
The violence was some of the worst since Lebanon's civil war ended in 1990. Back in this country, the Biden administration says that it is going to the U.S. Supreme Court to stop a Texas ban on most abortions. A lower court left the law in place last night. The statute bans most abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. A U.S. Capitol Police officer is now accused of obstructing justice after the January 6th assault on the complex. Michael Riley was arrested today. Federal prosecutors say he warned one rioter to take down incriminating posts on Facebook and kept him updated on the FBI's investigation. A former chief pilot for Boeing 737 MAX program pleaded not guilty to federal fraud charges today. Prosecutors say Mark Faulkner hid information about problems with an automated flight control system. It was later implicated in two plane crashes that killed 346 people. On Wall Street today, major indexes wound up their best week since early summer. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 382 points today to close at 35,294. The Nasdaq rose 74 points. The S&P 500 added 33. For the week, the three indexes were up 1.5% to 2%. And former President Bill Clinton spent a third day hospitalized in Southern California. An aide said the 75-year-old is recovering from a urological infection. President Biden spoke with Mr. Clinton by phone today and said he's doing fine. Still to come on the NewsHour, some 30 countries unite in the global fight against ransomware. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart analyze President Biden's battle against anti-vaccine mandates. One city's recent efforts to honor a black man whose land was taken away from him decades ago, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The FDA panel that recommended a second shot of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine today has been busy the past 2 days considering whether more Americans should get a booster dose and when. William Brangham helps us break down what people need to know.
That's right. In addition to their J&J recommendation, this panel also looked at whether mixing doses from different manufacturers can improve protection against the virus. Their recommendations still have to be approved by the FDA and the CDC. We explore this with two people. Dr. Celine Gounder is an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist at New York University's Grossman School of Medicine, and she cares for patients at Bellevue Hospital Center. And Dr. Ashish Jha, he is the dean of Brown University's School of Public Health. Good evening to you both. Thank you both very much for being here. Dr. Gounder, to you first. So this advisory panel recommends this booster, the second dose of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for all adults 18 and over. We should say also, by the way, that Johnson & Johnson is a funder of the NewsHour. But the company did get kind of roughed up today during the testimony. There was questions about their data. One panelist seemed to suggest that this should have been a two-dose vaccine all along. All of that said, do you think the evidence for this booster is merited?
Look, I do think it was noble to try to have a single dose vaccine. I think from the perspective of operations logistics, getting people vaccinated, from an equity perspective, that it meant only one appointment, time off work, childcare associated with that. You know, and I think many of us had hoped that this would truly stand up the test of time. But what we've seen over time is that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine does not perform as well as the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine with respect to the more critical outcomes, in particular severe disease, hospitalization, and death, not just with respect to breakthrough infection. And what we are seeing is that with an additional dose of vaccine, you really do boost the immunity with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Dr. Jha, could you help remind us why we're actually having this conversation about boosters? Is it because the vaccines are slipping somewhat in their efficacy? Is it because the Delta variant is so potent? I mean, why are we having this conversation?
Yeah, William, it's a really critical question. The reason we are having this is really twofold. One is we are seeing some waning of the effectiveness of vaccines, typically about 6 months after the second dose for the mRNA vaccines and 2 months after the J&J vaccine. But the other is the Delta variant. I mean, the Delta variant is so contagious and it infects people with such high viral loads that you need a very high level of protection to keep yourself safe. And what we're finding is 6 months after the vaccine, it's just no longer as good as it needs to be, particularly for high-risk people where a breakthrough infection can end up being a real problem. That's what we're seeing. That's what we saw in Israel. That's what we're seeing in European countries. And that's what we're starting to see here in the United States.
Dr. Gounder, as I mentioned at the beginning, there was this also a discussion today about whether or not people can mix and match vaccines. And there wasn't a vote taken on that, but it seems that there was support for that idea. Again, explain why someone might want to do that. If I took A, why do I want to have a shot of B next time around?
Well, think of it like maybe a mugshot of a criminal. If you have two different photographs, one from the front, one from the side, you have a better chance of recognizing that person out in public than if you only have one snapshot. And similarly, these vaccines give your immune system different ways of looking at the virus, and so your immune system has a better shot at recognizing it down the line.
I love this idea of the virus having a mugshot and we see two sides of its face to help better figure out how to get it. Dr. Jha, a broader question about the pandemic. I mean, we are seeing a couple of weeks of pretty good news. Cases, hospitalizations, and deaths all seem to be on a downward trajectory. I mean, we are still losing, we should say, somewhere around 1,800 people a day, which is, of course, tragic, and we've become somewhat inured to these numbers. But do you have a good sense as to why those trends seem to be going down right now?
Yeah, it's a great question, William. What we're seeing is dramatic fall-offs in infections in the South. My sense is part of that is driven by the fact that the Deep South tends to be very, very hot over the summer, and so people spend a lot of time indoors. As the weather cools, people can start spending a bit more time outdoors. That's helping. There's also, we have seen this come up over and over again with the Delta variant, without a very clear explanation, that it tends to do these very steep rises, lasts about 2 months, and then it turns back down. We did see that in the UK. We saw that in India. So there's an element of this that's not fully understood. But I am not so convinced yet that the country is completely out of the woods. It is getting colder here in the north, in the Midwest and Great Plains states where vaccination numbers are still low. I remain worried that there are parts of our country that are still quite vulnerable to more cases, infections, and deaths. So we have to be careful as we go into the fall and winter.
Certainly. And Dr. Gounder, this similar question to you. I don't want to portray this as light at the end of the tunnel or as Ashish is saying that we are anywhere near the end of this. Do you think, though, that this trend will continue and yet we then might have a rough fall or winter? Or do you think this might be a change for the better more permanently?
Well, I do think we need to be cautious, particularly in parts of the country where people will be spending more time indoors, so the Northeast, for example. In addition, we do see a bump in the transmission of respiratory viruses, whether that's SARS-CoV-2 or influenza or just regular cough and cold viruses in the winter months, and especially around holidays like Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, when people are traveling more. And so I do think we will see maybe not an extreme surge like we've seen over the course of the summer, but I do think we'll see an increase in cases later this fall.
And Dr. Jha, this about this cyclical nature that you were describing, I think it's very frustrating for people who like to think, we're near the end of this. Can we be done with all these mitigation measures? Are we done or are we not done? What do you mean I got to go back to wearing masks again? Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo today described this as us lurching between crisis and complacency. It seems that that poses a real challenge for public health officials on how to communicate that we're not necessarily sure how this roller coaster is going to go.
Yeah, there's a complexity here, because while we don't know exactly how it's going to go, it is not like we have no information, we have no idea. I think we are, at this point, pretty confident that this fall and winter will be clearly better than last one, because there is so much population immunity. It is hard to predict exactly the bumps up and down, but the bumps are getting smaller. I believe the worst of the pandemic is behind us at this point. That doesn't mean we're out of the woods. We have some tough days. And the key point is pandemics are always, they're always changing and they always pose new challenges. And we just have to be flexible as we get through the next 3 to 6 months. That might mean periods of time where we're masking indoors, other periods of time where we can relax some of those restrictions. I think we're heading in the right direction, but we have to be willing to be flexible as we go through the months ahead.
And Dr. Gounder, in this conversation on potentially the waning of this pandemic, there's a lot of discussion as to whether this virus will become endemic. Can you explain the terminology there? What does that mean? And do you think we're headed in that direction?
I do think we're heading towards endemicity, where the virus is endemic. What that means is that you have an ongoing, steady level of transmission of the virus in the community. You're not having these big surges like we've been having over the course of the last almost 2 years now, but that you do have ongoing, stable transmission. And so that does mean that it is important that everybody get vaccinated. If you have not been exposed to this, there's a decent chance over the next couple of years you certainly would be. And you would still be at risk for the disease and other severe consequences of getting infected.
And Dr. Jha, last question to you. We're seeing these panels and these recommendations for boosters coming out, and we believe these approvals will continue to come. Is it your sense that we will need boosters going forward, that we may all get a second or third booster now, but then down the road, 6 months, a year, or 2 years, that we might be doing this, re-upping these over and over again?
Yeah, that is my sense, William. I mean, I think given the contagiousness of Delta, and given that my sense is going to be the variant that's going to be with us for a while, what we're going to see is periods of time where you have waning immunity, and people are going to need to get revaccinated or get boosted up again. My best guess is it's probably going to be annual for a while, the way we get flu shots for, you know, and that is something we can handle. Our system can handle that. But I think the idea that somehow this would be the last shot we'd ever get in our lives, probably not. We should be ready for, at least for the next few years, maybe an annual booster for this virus.
All right, Dr. Ashish Jha and Dr. Celine Gounder, always good to see you both. Thank you very much.
The Treasury Department said today that U.S. companies are paying $102 million in ransomware payments every month. The White House this week convened leaders from 30 countries to coordinate efforts against what has become a growing global problem. Nick Schifrin has that story.
Just in the past 6 months, ransomware hackers debilitated one of the U.S.'s largest meat producers and a crucial pipeline. They disrupted Ireland's national health system, and they are currently wreaking havoc in an Israeli hospital system, which had to cancel all non-emergency procedures. At this week's virtual conference, the countries pledged to improve cooperation in law enforcement, inhibit, trace, and interdict ransomware payments, and harden infrastructure. Anne Neuberger is the Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology. She organized the conference and joins me now. Anne Neuberger, welcome to the NewsHour. So talk about this conference. This was the largest multinational gathering to discuss ransomware. What specific commitments did you get from these 30 countries?
Really great question, Nick. Ransomware is a transnational threat. I'll unpack that with the example that you used, the Israeli hospital. In that case, you could have the human attackers in one country, the exchanges that they use to facilitate the movement of illicit currency in a second, registered in one country, operating in a third country, and the infrastructure from which they conducted an attack in yet a fourth, fifth, or sixth country. So we brought countries together to really coordinate our fight against ransomware. And the key takeaway was countries talked about what's working today in that cooperation, where the gaps are, and committing to working together to across those gaps to fight ransomware more effectively.
Many of the most pernicious cyber criminals operate from inside Russia. China is a leader on cyber espionage. Why was China and Russia not invited?
So from a Russian perspective, as you know, President Biden established a high-level White House to Kremlin direct discussion on ransomware when he last met President Putin at a summit in June. And we've had candid, professional, and direct exchanges in that summit, in that exchange, regarding ransomware and regarding criminals operating from within Russia. So we felt that was the most effective way to address that. And you noted from a Chinese perspective, as you know, we did similarly an attribution regarding China harboring ransomware actors a number of months ago. But with regard to who was included, we brought together countries who each have a stake in truly addressing those components, building resilience, tracing illicit use of virtual currencies, addressing and putting in place, implementing diplomatic norms, and disrupting those actors. And this is not the last meeting. It was a first meeting of a set of countries, and we look forward to including more countries in that fight moving forward.
The U.S. has shared with Russia specific names of cyber criminals who operate inside of Russia that it wants to see prosecuted by Russian authorities. And we have seen a few of those cyber criminals go dark. Is that because the Russian government has cracked down on them?
I won't speak to the causes at this moment. What we're focused on is the outcomes. And we're really looking to see a reduction in core disruptive ransomware attacks against critical infrastructure overall. And certainly, the information that we've shared has been to provide information regarding that and looking to the Russian government to take key next steps.
You said you're focused on outcomes. You've suggested in the past that you've seen some signs that ransomware groups have responded to administration pressure. But with all due respect, how would you know if ransomware is improving if the FBI says it only has visibility into 25% of ransomware in the U.S.?
It's a good question. Ransomware is a tough threat, and one of the challenges the U.S. government has is having adequate visibility because so many ransomware attacks are not reported. And that's one of the reasons why encouraging notification to the U.S. government when ransomware attacks occurs, so we can better trace the attackers, trace the infrastructure that they use to drive disruption efforts, is so important. What we're focused on fundamentally are the four approaches to disrupt ransomware, and seeing and testing each one of those approaches, as I noted, and looking to see what are the outcomes. Overall, do we see a reduction in ransomware? You noted the limited visibility the U.S. government has, and that's why we're working so closely with the private sector to see what they see as well and to incorporate that into our overall strategy.
Those disruption methods that you have discussed and that were in the joint statement do not include offensive operations. Do you believe the U.S. should, as cyber expert Dmitry Alperovitch recently suggested, reveal criminals' details, take down payment servers, and hack the hackers, as the U.S. did against ISIS?
We're trying a lot of creative approaches. Not all are we public about, not all can we talk about, but we're fully committed to ensuring that it's a lot harder for attackers to use global infrastructure, global currency exchanges to pursue their pernicious work.
You have tried, as you've mentioned tonight, to crack down on cryptocurrency, but some investors in cryptocurrency are pushing back, saying that they do not want to share the details of any of the holders of that cryptocurrency. How can you actually solve this problem without those investors' support?
So two questions. One is, we really believe in the innovation that cryptocurrency brings, for example, access for the unbanked. We also believe that we need to crack down on illicit use of cryptocurrency. In some ways, the public nature of the blockchain makes cryptocurrency and there's greater visibility into various transactions. Holding exchanges accountable for know your customer rules, which they're accountable for under current regulatory practices, where they need to know who is opening an exchange account and report that, is the path that we will use. So it's currently required under U.S. law for a cryptocurrency exchange to really look into somebody opening an account to know, is this a legitimate use for investment, for legitimate transactions, purchasing a painting, whatever the purchase is, or is it somebody who's using it to launder illicit funds, as ransomware attackers do?
Ann Neuberger, Deputy National Security Advisor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick.
From supply chain bottlenecks to the vaccine mandate debate and the Virginia governor's race, it has been a busy week in politics. And that brings us to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post, who's joining us tonight from home. And we welcome both of you on this Friday night. It's very good to see you. And Jonathan at home, we love the flowers.
They're back.
They're back. Jonathan, let's start with this, I love this term, supply chain. So much attention on this, bottlenecks, people can't get what they ordered on time. President Biden now trying to get his arms around this by telling the ports they have to stay open 24/7, or at least working with the ports to get that done and taking other steps. In the end, though, this is largely a private sector thing. It's an international phenomenon. Do the American people, do you think voters will get that?
No. The short answer to that question is no, because you put your finger on it, Judy. The president of the United States doesn't have any control, really, over the economy, doesn't have any control over private industries and whether their shipments get in or get out. However, this is always a political problem for the president of the United States, no matter who that person is, no matter what the party. But the problem for President Biden is going to be, he ran on competence. He ran on being the person following a very chaotic presidency that was going to bring, excuse me, order to politics, but also competency to executing the duties of the job. I know I just said that the president has no control over the economy, but that doesn't matter to the American people when, you know, their goods don't come in on time, or they can't find a job, or their wages aren't going up. They don't care about the intricacies of why that is. They care that the president of the United States said things would be better, and they're not better. That is the political problem that the president has here in all this.
So how much of a headache is this for the president?
Yeah, I think pretty significant, as Jonathan said. When people just judge the economy, they don't care what's causing it. They are in a bad mood. And if they're in a bad mood because they can't get Christmas presents, they're gonna take it out on the politicians. The worrying thing for me is the inflation rate. Is the inflation rate is much higher than many economists said, and it's in real estate. Its rental is going up, housing costs are just skyrocketing. And when you have rents going up and you have wages going up as fast as they are, then that leads to long-term inflation. And the worry for me, this whole supply chain problem is caused by supply and demand. There's incredible amounts of demand because people were locked down for a year and a half, and there's not so much supply because the factories are shut or the ports were shut. And we now have huge demand. We're about possibly, to spend another $3.5 trillion, pour that into the economy. That's going to further increase demand and possibly further increase inflationary pressures. And so for the people trying to pass this reconciliation bill and the infrastructure bill, it has to be a bit of concern that they're about to create even more inflation. And so I'm not sure Biden is to blame, but it does have some policy effects on how we talk about these gigantic bills.
And there is reporting that they're going to negotiate that number down. But still, Jonathan, what are a president's options when it comes to something like inflation? I mean, you and David both agree there are limits to what a president can do. So what are the options?
I mean, I guess the option is to look at the Fed chairman and say, but please do something to tamp the brakes as much as you can on inflation. But, you know, look to switch gears a little bit. I think that the administration is hoping to pick up on what David was just talking about in terms of the 3.5 reconciliation bill. The president today said flat out, it's not going to be $3.5 trillion. You know, a couple weeks ago, the signals were there that $3.5 trillion is not going to be the number, that it has to be lower, and that's what the battle is going on in terms of, you know, the negotiations on this bill. You know, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, was on with the Pod Save America guys, who she worked with during the Obama administration, and the key thing that she was talking about is urgency. These negotiations aren't going to go on forever. This must get passed. Today on Washington Post Live, I interviewed the Labor Secretary, Marty Walsh, who also had the similar message that the provisions of the Build Back Better Act are needed, and they are needed now. And, you know, when we're talking about supply chain disruptions, when we're talking about inflation, when we're talking about American families hurting, from the Biden administration's perspective, yeah, they have no control over the economy, but on the things that they do have control over, which is passing a reconciliation bill, right, and an infrastructure bill, they want to get that done. And whether that adds to inflation or not remains to be seen, because there's no bill to talk about just yet.
How much does timing matter in all this, whether they get it passed? You know, they're saying we'd love to get it done by the end of October. People are saying that's just not realistic.
Yeah, I don't think it matters that much. I mean, the inflationary worries are an argument for phasing in a lot of the things they want to do and make it a little slower so you don't get this big burst of demand. One of the things that's really puzzled me for 2 years is politics operates on the position that if a politician does something for you, you reward him with support, him or her with support. Politicians over the last 2 years have poured $5 trillion into people's pockets. They've basically, not even basically, literally written them checks. And it has not helped the politicians at all. Donald Trump did not see his favorability approval when he was writing checks. Joe Biden did not see his favorability go up when he was writing a check. So it's as if you can do great favors for people and they don't reward you. And so I don't know how to explain this phenomenon, but it's unusual. And so it could be that political favorability is detached from what kind of services are being offered, or it could be, which is what I suspect, they will, the voters will punish you for bad things, they will not reward you for good things. And that's not a good position to be in if you're president of the United States.
Well, talking about headaches that President Biden is dealing with right now, Jonathan, he's been arguing a pandemic still underway. Companies need to mandate as much as they can. Employers need to mandate that people who work there take the vaccine. Getting a lot of pushback from Republicans, from Republican governors. Where do you see that battle going?
Well, I'm just going to repeat what I've said on our air many times. It is reprehensible that Republican governors are standing in the way of public health officials from being able to help their states and their communities get a handle on this pandemic. The idea that a governor would stand in the way of private enterprise from being able to say to their employees, you know what, you need to have a mask. You need to get the vaccine if you want to continue working here. This is not supposed to be political. This is supposed to be about public health. And the sooner we get a handle on the coronavirus pandemic, the sooner all these things we've been talking about, unemployment, inflationary pressures, the need to have a reconciliation bill and an infrastructure bill to get people back to work, won't be necessary. But when you have Republican governors like Ron DeSantis in Florida or Governor Abbott in Texas doing these things, they're politicizing a public health emergency, and they're also slowing down the economic recovery that the people in their states desperately need.
So it is political. It has become political.
Yeah, and I agree. Reprehensible is a pretty good word for it. It's a philosophical bait and switch. There are some things that are matters of individual liberty, where how you want to vote, how you want to dress. Some things are matters of communal health and safety. And a stop sign is a matter of communal health and safety. And this vaccination is a matter of communal health and safety. So to say it's a matter of individual liberty is just not true. And they're just making it so political. Second, we're learning that the people who are not taking the vaccine, most of them are not like adamant vaccine haters. They're hesitant. They've got some underlying health issues, or they're just concerned, or they have low trust in the healthcare system, often for good historical reasons. And if you mandate it, it turns out they get the shot. And so the Times reported today, United Airlines has 67,000 employees. They mandated. Only 232 said no. So if you mandate it, it turns out it works. People get the shot, and that increases public health. So it's not like they're forcing people to do things. They're nudging them to do what's in the common good.
You're saying people themselves are not always motivated by politics.
Right. Well,
it's
not like they're a bunch of Tucker Carlson saying, no, this is tyranny. They have concerns. And if you nudge them, if you try to explain, if you have trusted people saying, no, the vaccine is safe, they will get the vaccine.
Jonathan, in the couple of minutes we have left, I want to turn you both back to the Virginia governor's race. We've talked about it a little bit before. This week, we had President Trump in Virginia at a rally, again saying the 2020 election was stolen from him. But among other things, the crowd was asked to pledge allegiance to a flag that flew over the United States Capitol on January the 6th. The Republican, Glenn Youngkin, didn't answer a question about it at the time. Later said he thought it was the wrong thing to do. But where are we headed on this issue? Other Republican candidates may be asked to do the same thing.
I used the word I used earlier, reprehensible. Glenn Youngkin was not there. His running mate was there but left before the program got started. But the fact that Glenn Youngkin did not automatically and vigorously denounce what happened at that rally is very concerning. Terry McAuliffe jumped on it right away, criticized him. I saw an ad this morning hammering him over this, and rightfully so. This is happening in the Virginia governor's race, but that video that you just showed and what it represents is more than Virginia. It is about our American democracy and how there are people out there who are wallowing in the big lie, pledging allegiance to flags that were flown over a rally that was part of the insurrection that sought to overturn a free and fair election in this country. That should not be a Democratic issue. That not should be a Republican issue. That should be an American issue. And Glenn Youngkin should have jumped out there immediately and said that that is wrong and I don't want any part of it. And yet he didn't.
Just 30 seconds.
I give him a little more credit. When I read the transcript of when he was asked, it wasn't clear to me he understood the question was about, he might have thought the question was about a Pledge of Allegiance, not about January 6th. I think once he knew it was about January 6th, he said it was weird and wrong. And so I think he was clear. The question is whether voters in Virginia are going to vote on Donald Trump. My impression is they're going to vote on the economy and on COVID, the issues that directly affect them, not so much Donald Trump, but I could be wrong.
Well, we have a date certain when that election takes place. We will find out. David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, thank you both.
Thanks, Judy.
A newly dedicated park outside St. Louis, Missouri, is one of the latest attempts to reconcile a decades-old wrong brought about by eminent domain, the power that governments have to seize private property for public use. Historically, urban renewal and eminent domain have separated hundreds of thousands of African Americans from their property and locked them out of generational wealth. I'm joined now by our St. Louis community reporter, Gabrielle Hayes. Welcome, Gabrielle, this evening. So this all happened, started back in the 1950s. Tell us what happened in St. Louis.
Yeah, so Dr. Howard P. Venable was a musician, an ophthalmologist. He was a man of many talents. And after going to medical school and getting married and having a daughter, he wanted to buy a home. And so in 1956, he bought two plots of land in Creve Coeur and wanted to build a house on one. The issue was the people in his neighborhood and local government didn't want him to live there. And so they pulled out all the stops, including the eminent domain doctrine, to make sure that he couldn't live there. And so they went back and forth through the courts. He sued several times. And in the end, he lost and had to move to Baldwin Hills. And that's where he settled until he died in 1998.
What argument did the city use in taking his property? And did they end up compensating him?
Yeah, so they use the eminent domain doctrine, which allows the government or governments to seize land for public use if they provide compensation. The thing was, Dr. Venable wanted to keep his land and he wanted to live there. And so he fought and fought as long as he could. In the end, we're told by people who've tracked the case and by documents that in the very end, I believe in 1959, he was paid $31,000 to settle that action. And so that's important to consider, especially when we talk about now, because if you look at homes homes that sit on that street, they've gone for over $1 million, right? So you think about him getting $31,000 in the 50s and what that would look like today, that matters.
And as you said, he fought it for years. His family hasn't forgotten. And just recently, there's been something dedicated in his honor, in his memory, that his family has insisted on. What are they saying about all this right now?
Yeah, so the family has been involved from the very start. The city of Creve Coeur has acknowledged what happened. Their sort of journey started in 2019. They established a task force, and they've been to work with the family to kind of figure out how to move forward, right, and how to make sure that this story isn't forgotten. And so they created a task force. They rededicated that land to Dr. Venable, so now it bears his name. But the family also wants to make sure that it doesn't end there. In fact, his nieces and nephews have said this cannot be a one-off, right? That can't be the end of the road, is changing the name on the sign. And even the city has recognized this as well. So their hope and what they're asking for is not only that the name of the park be changed, but also for there be an annual day of recognition and for there to be some type of program in Creve Coeur to make sure that people of color have an equal opportunity to live in that neighborhood. They want a financial contribution to Washington University in Dr. Venable's name to ensure that students have an opportunity to learn there. So they are very much so part of this process, but for them it's bigger than just acknowledging the story. It's about making sure that it moves forward and that no one forgets.
It's so important to tell this story. Gabrielle Hayes, who is our community's reporter in St. Louis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can read Gabrielle's full report on our website, pbs.org/newshour. It was the summer of 1969, and video cameras in New York captured a series of concerts in Harlem featuring artists who would go on to become musical legends, the likes of Stevie Wonder, Nina Simone, and Gladys Knight. But for decades, no one was interested in the footage. The musician known as Questlove took up the challenge in a documentary that brings history to life. It's part of his ongoing work in music and also now in a new book. Jeffrey Brown talked with Questlove recently for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Ladies and gentlemen, Gladys Knight!
The musicians, some all-time greats. Don't you know that I heard it through the grapevine? Oh, I heard since the dawning of the age of Aquarius. The music lifting you to the sky. The setting, the Harlem Cultural Festival in 1969. All of it stunning and amazing to see in 2021. But even more mind-blowing, how close it came to being lost forever.
The moment you saw what happened here, you knew you were onto something. This was something big.
Absolutely, yeah. And even to be here and to see the structure, like, I definitely remember this shot.
The renowned musician Amir Thompson, better known as Questlove, made his directorial debut this year with the acclaimed documentary, Summer of Soul.
Are you ready, black people? Are you ready?
But when we met recently in Marcus Garvey Park, the site of the original concert 52 years ago, when it was still called Mount Morris Park, he told me he hesitated to take on the project when first shown the archival footage.
I was just like, no, this is too much responsibility. This is not just putting a concert together. This is correcting history, and I didn't know if I was worthy enough to be in the position to be the person that leads the charge.
A very specific time and place in history. Through a series of concerts attracting some 300,000 over 6 weekends in the hot summer of 1969,
it took me by surprise.
The film documents a musical revolution as it was taking place. It also captures expressions of black pride and power and demands for social justice that offered Thompson another way in.
It wasn't lost on us that literally at the same time that we're in the editing process of the film, suddenly there's a political charge in the air that was just like 50 years ago. And then once the knobs started turning up a little bit more with the Black Lives Matter protests, then I was like, wow, like the same exact things that we're editing right now is happening in real time.
Questlove, now 50, is a man who clearly loves to connect to different kinds of music, art forms, histories. He's been around music his whole life, joining his parents in soul and doo-wop bands even as a child. He first came to fame as drummer and co-founder of The Roots, a hip-hop band founded in Philadelphia in 1987. Roots started as house band on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon in 2009 and have continued with The Tonight Show. He's a DJ, producer, songwriter, author. He even hosts a food program looking at his love of cuisine and at equity issues.
And we even made Questlove into a little edamame bean here.
I'm eating my own face.
Thank you, brother. What's your name?
And he's deep into a lifelong role as music educator and historian.
I'm one of those people that when I learn something, I get excited. And I feel special and I feel like smarter. People want to feel enlightened. So my thing is like, I want to be the guy that throws the alley-oop shot and then you put the ball in the hoop and then you feel like, I did that. You know, I helped a little bit, but that to me is, that's the important part.
His new book, Music is History, is a kind of playlist of songs that speak to events since 1971, the year he was born. But it's a Questlove-style playlist, lesser-known songs matched with events in unexpected ways.
I personally believe that music is a Polaroid shot of life. And the way that I remember history, I frame it through music.
You're not picking the best known or most loved.
Not even the best known. And at that, you know, I'm still trying to provide, I'm trying to plant seeds.
Early hip-hop, he says, offered him a kind of education, learning about music through sampling from earlier recordings while connecting to contemporary issues in the lyrics.
Hip-hop planted seeds. Between 88 and 92, I went to the library a lot to look up old articles, to, you know, do those scroll things that they do at libraries. I mean, we have the internet now, but back then you had to stay at the library for 8 hours. That was my internet. And I kind of wanted to do the same thing. This time I'm using history to drop seeds on music that people should discover.
But even the classics can fall off the map. Thompson told me of teaching at NYU and realizing how few of his students knew of an album he and many consider a milestone of popular music. It's close to midnight. Michael Jackson's 1982 Thriller.
If there's a chance in time for people not to know, like, Michael Jackson's Thriller, was that a thing back in the day? Like, that's what I knew. Oh, everything's up for grabs. Like, I can never take for granted that history will be remembered. And it's not glamorous. Like, who gets in the rap game to want to be, like, your hall monitor teacher? Okay, class, like, that sort of thing.
Time to remember history.
But,
you
know, I guess you could say that I'm music's hall monitor. So.
There's another connecting thread in his work, one embedded in the Summer of Soul film project. Freedom. 1969, of course, was also the year of Woodstock, and the film that came out the following year helped define and enshrine an era and its music. The Harlem Cultural Festival was shot by a director named Hal Tulchin with hopes it too would become a film. But he never found a distributor, and the footage sat in a basement for decades.
And I wonder, if this film were allotted the same path, like, would it have found me? For a lot of, not even African Americans, but just people in general that love music, I just thought, like, instantly, this film could have changed lives.
It raises the question of sort of what gets remembered in American culture, what gets honored. Woodstock did, the Harlem Cultural Festival did not.
Right.
Why has it been so hard to preserve this and other black music?
I'm so in love with music and just the passion that I have for it. I want people to see the magic that I see. I've got sunshine. And oftentimes, because black creators aren't seen as artists or in importance, like their canon isn't held up the same way, it's often seen as disposable. Our history's disposable. And that, to me, that's the true meaning of, in my definition, of what Black Lives Matter means, is that even our creations, our art, our stories are just as important and life-changing.
Some very good news. Amir Thompson, Questlove, says since the film came out, he's heard from archives all over the country telling him of other largely unknown treasures. That means there's more to come. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in Marcus Garvey Park in Harlem, New York.
Ken Mascara has been the sheriff of St. Lucie County in Florida for the past 20 years. He has seen funding for mental health facilities plummet. And as a result, more and more mentally ill patients end up languishing behind bars. Tonight, he gives his brief but spectacular take on making county jails safer and smarter. This piece was filmed prior to the pandemic.
Well, if you have a loved one that's suffering from mental illness, it would only take a split second and a bad decision for them to end up in a county jail. A couple of years ago, we had I think he just turned 18 years old, act up in a school. He was subsequently arrested for battery, I believe, brought to this facility, and he was severely autistic. He did not have parents. He was in a foster home. It took an enormous effort by all of our partners to get him removed from our jail into a inpatient treatment facility. Here's a kid that should have never been in our facility, never. I'm the sheriff of St. Lucie County. I've been here for 20 years.
Get a designated driver. If not this holiday season, these might be the only lights that you see.
Over the past two decades, we have seen funding from the legislature diminish to mental health inpatient and outpatient facilities and programs. So people who do suffer from mental illness have no place to go. Or law enforcement agencies that deal with mental health individuals, they tend to bring them to jail because there's no other place to bring them. Last year, it was roughly around 35% of our inmates that are on psychotropic medications. We were never, ever in a position to handle such severity of mental health inmates. We do have a section of the jail carved out that our mental health inmates reside in. And of course, we separate them from every other inmate. Because we are a detention facility and awaiting inmates to go to trial, we have some inmates that have been here 5 or 6 years with us during the pendency of their trial. How do we shift jail beds to treatment beds? It's going to take money. It's going to take a committed governor, a committed legislature that funds these initiatives that really addresses mental illness as well as drug dependency. We have many programs here that we initiated that divert people out of our jail and in general out of the criminal justice system. And I think in the long run, those will benefit not only the inmate, not only the criminal justice system, but our community. You know, there's a sheriff, I won't mention his name, that always touted himself as being the toughest sheriff in America. I want to be known as one of the smartest sheriffs in America. My name is Ken Mascara, and this is my brief but spectacular take on the tragedy of mentally ill in county jails.
Thank you for speaking out on that. And you can watch all of our brief but spectacular episodes at pbs.org/newshour/brief. And be sure to watch Washington Week tonight. My colleague Yamiche Alcindor moderates a discussion on the latest on the January 6th investigation, political culture wars, and the nation's economic challenges. That's tonight on PBS. And coming up on NewsHour Weekend, a special two-part report on the growing land back movement as some Native American tribes choose to buy back ancestral lands that were taken from them. That is tomorrow and Sunday night on PBS NewsHour Weekend. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here Monday evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe and have a good weekend.